Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the lawyers when we come back. You know, yesterday I was giving you some information from the International Forecaster concerning ARMs. ARMs, those are adjustable rate mortgages. I tied that in with the story that we were talking about at the time concerning voting. Vote the bad guys out. That's what Bob Chapman is recommending, and of course that's what all of the news commentators, or at least all of the talk radio commentators, have to say. They believe that if we can just give you people, the American voters, the information about all the bad things that are going on in this country, that you're going to vote the bad guys out and vote the good guys in and solve all of our problems. And I pointed out yesterday that the people who can't even count, the people who don't even know how to figure the interest rates on their mortgages, the people who do not know what it is that's going to trigger their bankruptcy, are the voters that we're counting on, the people with the good common sense who are going to throw out the bad guys and put in the good guys. Now that's going to happen when hell freezes over. It's my contention that there are some problems out here. The problems need to be solved. I don't know if knowing about more and more problems is the solution. It certainly is true that you can't solve a problem that you don't know about. But just knowing about the problem doesn't solve it. It requires some kind of positive action. Somebody somewhere has to get up off of his dead ass and go out and physically do something. Even if it's just you all by yourself in your own family, on your own farm, in your own apartment, in the middle of Cleveland, Ohio, somebody to alleviate the problem has to physically do something. Kind of reminds me of this Hurricane Katrina. There's a little piece here in the forecaster here about how the government is dealing with this Hurricane Katrina down in New Orleans. And it seems that the FEMA people and the Small Business Administration simply are not delivering the money that is necessary for those people to rebuild their businesses and rebuild their houses. Now, at some point in time, somebody somewhere has to get up and go out and physically rebuild those houses. And I think that most of the people down there are waiting for the government to come down and do it for them. I think that would be another cold day in hell. Or you can wait and wait and wait. If the government is going to turn it over to Halliburton so that Halliburton can make a big profit off of it, that might solve your problem. Maybe they'll come down and rebuild at that point in time. Let's see what I'm talking about here. I'm trying to find it here. I'm going to come to it here before we finish the week, but here it is. The White House has rejected hurricane disaster recovery loans at a higher rate than any other administration in the last 15 years. Let me just pause here now, and let's think about this for a second. You people down on the Gulf Coast now, you've been ravaged by the hurricanes. Your houses are knocked down. Your churches are out of operation. They're destroyed. Everything's been flooded. Your businesses are closed. And the government, the president goes down, he's been down there about 5 or 6 times, and the president says, we're going to help you people rebuild. By God, we're going to be down here. We're behind you 1,000%. Sounds like that Eagleton trip, you know, back in the 70s, there was a guy named McGovern running for president. And he said he was behind his vice presidential candidate, Thomas Eagleton, you know, 1,000%. Well, that was for about 2 days, and then he dumped him. You'll know them by their fruits. You will know your government by its fruits. What do they actually do? Well, listen to this. Over the past 15 years, the Small Business Administration has been making loans to disaster victims. Here's the worst disaster to strike America in our history, and the SBA and FEMA are working at a slower pace than they have over the past 15 years. Now, what does that tell you? Does it tell you that the government is incompetent, or does it tell you that the government is competent, but that they have another agenda, that they don't want to rebuild, that they want to rebuild, but over a longer period of time? And if that's the case, then what's the agenda? What is it that we're trying to accomplish here? Now, we're spending approximately, if I got my numbers right, it keeps going up every day, about $5 billion a week in Iraq. Now, boys and girls, I'm not against the Iraq war. I think that we need an Iraq war. We need the oil. And the president didn't tell you the truth about the reason for going to Iraq. It's oil. Peak oil has arrived. Whether it's political or physical, peak oil has arrived. We need the oil here in America. To hell with the Japanese, to hell with the Chinese. We need the oil, and we're there to take that oil. We are building a $600 million. Got that $600 million, that's a little over half a billion dollar building over there called the embassy in Baghdad. We are in the process of staffing that embassy with 1,000 bureaucrats. It's going to be the biggest embassy in the world. Bar none. Biggest embassy in the world. Now, does that tell you that we're getting ready to withdraw from Iraq? We are in the process of building 5 air bases in Iraq. Does that tell you that we're getting ready to withdraw from Iraq and turn that mess over to the Iraqis? Come on, kids. Let's grow up and get real. You're reading it in your newspapers every day. I don't think you're paying attention. We're going to be in Iraq forever. Well, forever meaning until they run out of oil. As soon as they run out of oil, then we don't have any reason to stay there. Now, we Americans already have the oil in Saudi Arabia. We now have the oil in Iraq. We have the oil in Kuwait. We have the oil in the United Arab Emirates. We have the oil in Venezuela. We have the oil in Nigeria. And everybody in the world needs that oil. And America controls it. Now, that's the way that game is being played. Now, while we're spending $5 billion a week over in Iraq for a very necessary, a very imperative part of the American empire, here at home, you people down on the Gulf Coast who just have been ravaged by God Almighty himself, by the way, are waiting for your government to give you some money so that you can rebuild your buildings, rebuild your homes, rebuild your churches and your factories, and et cetera, and get back into operation. Well, the government is working at the slowest pace that they have since 1990. Now, you would think that they would be working at the fastest pace that they have since 1990 to accomplish that goal. Now, the president has been down there 5 times promising you people, and I said you'll know him by his fruits. Now, what kind of fruits are you seeing down there? Now, business and home loan approval rates averaged about 60% after Hurricane Andrew. Now, it was about 1992, wasn't it? Hurricane Andrew down in Florida, 60%. After Wilma roared through South Florida last year, the approval rate for low-interest taxpayer-guaranteed loans by the SBA dropped to barely 15% overall. Boys and girls, the loan approval rate today is 1/4 what it was 15 years ago. Now, what does that tell you? I mean, if you're going to rebuild down there in New Orleans, you better roll up your sleeves and get busy, because this isn't going to come from Washington. This isn't going to come from your government. They've got other agendas. They've got other plans. Now, overall, Democrats set approval rates for home and business disaster loans since 2004 have averaged about 35%. That's about half what they were 15 years ago. The SBA has tripled its staff over the past year to deal with the series of major Gulf Coast hurricanes. Boy, that sounds like government, doesn't it? The SBA has tripled their staff, and they've cut their loans by 75%. We've got 3 times as many people turning out 1/4 the amount of work. Kind of sounds like our public school system, doesn't it? Now, you know, there's a solution to the public school system. Pull your kid out of the public school and educate him at home. You can't possibly do a worse job than is being done in the public schools. If you never taught that kid how to tie his shoelaces or potty trained him, for crying out loud, he couldn't do any worse. And the public school system, by the way, costs $500 billion a year plus. Let me give you the numbers on that one. So while we're talking about solutions, I'll just show you how to solve that problem. The public school system, nationwide, average, nationwide. If your kid is in a public school, he is scoring at the 50th percentile. That's a complex methodology for scoring this kid's smarts. So he scores at 50, all right? If you had that same kid, or you had another kid just like him, and you put him in a Catholic school, doesn't have to be Catholic, hell, it could be Baptist or any parochial school, he'll score at about the 80th percentile. 80. 30 percentiles higher if you just put him in a private school. Now you're sitting there saying, oh my God, I can't afford to send my kid to a private school. Okay, hang on. Yeah, you can. You could, and you ought to, but you won't. But he would score 60% higher if you had him in that private school, but it gets better than that. If you had your kid at home, educating your kid at home with one of these homeschooling programs, he would score on average at the 86th percentile. That's the highest that's been measured, 86. Homeschool. Now, if your kid's in an inner city school like Cleveland or Philadelphia, on average, he's scoring at the 28th percentile. 28. Got those numbers? Inner city schools, 28. Public schools, nationally, 50. Private school, 80. Homeschool, 86. Now, let me give you the numbers on what this is costing you. If you're sending your kid to school in the inner city school at the 28th percentile, on average, it's costing $19,000 per kid to educate that kid per year. Got that? $19,000 a year in the inner city public schools. Now, nationally, the entire public school system taken as a whole, scoring at the 50th percentile, only costs $7,000 a year. You pay nearly three times as much to get half the smarts in the inner city. Now, that'll tell you a story. The more money you spend on public education, the dumber your kid will be. And those are the numbers that prove it. And those come right out of the Department of Education. That's what they admit to. I would venture a guess and say that those numbers are probably untrue. They're probably lying through their teeth. It could only be worse than that, but that's what they're admitting to. But watch this. If you're sending your kid to a private school, I mean, you could send your kid to a Catholic school down the street, and it would cost, on average, $2,400 a year to educate that kid in a private school. Now, can you tell me why it is that you can educate a kid in a private school for less than half? It's only a third of what it costs to educate him in public school. Can you explain that one to me? It's beyond me, just being a poor old country boy. And then get this. The 86th percentile, you know, people that educate their kids at home, it costs $546 a year on average to buy that homeschool program and educate your kid at home. $546. So it costs $500 at home, $2,500 in a private school, $7,000 in a public school. Unless you really want your kid to be dumbed down, then you send him to an inner city public school, costs $19,000 to educate that kid, and you get 25 or about one half of the national average, 28th percentile versus 50. Now there's a solution to the problem. I mean, it doesn't take rocket science to figure out the public school system is broke. See, it's broke. I don't mean they're out of money. They got all the money in the world. I mean, the system's broke. It don't work. It doesn't educate children. That's what it doesn't do. Now, if you want your kid to be sent to a daycare center where he's not going to be educated, public school has got it over all the rest of them, hands down. My God, you know you have arrived. That's where you want to send them. Now, the SBA has tripled its staff over the past year to deal with a series of major Gulf Coast hurricanes. Tripled their staff and turned out 25% of the work. Despite the increase from 1,500 to 4,500, the report found the agency's approval rate has continued to drop with each disaster. The approval rate. Well, God bless you Americans out there. You're not approving of this incompetence. The SBA, on top of this, said last week that it was almost out of disaster money, but they had plenty of money for that rat hole known as Iraq. Fortunately, Congress gave the SBA $100 million in February, and the Senate approved legislation to provide $712 million with no thanks to the White House. Okay, hang on here, guys. Hang on, kids. Do you know how much $1 billion is? You're spending $5 billion a week in Iraq. $5 billion. Okay, so we take 5 times 1,000. That's how much $1 billion is. It's 5,000 million. That's how much we're spending on Iraq. $5,000 million a week. All right. Now, Congress has appropriated for one entire year for the SBA, for you people down there on the Gulf Coast. Got this? Gulf Coast. $100 million. Now, that's one-tenth of a billion. In other words, for the entire year, the SBA is going to loan you people down there on the Gulf Coast one-tenth of $1 billion, but they're going to spend $5 billion a week. How much is that? My God, 5 times 52. 52 times 5. $260 billion this year on Iraq. Got that? In 2 years, the amount of money that we're spending on Iraq in 2 years, you'd have the $500 billion that the president says it's going to take to rebuild the Gulf Coast. And by the way, that's assuming that you want to rebuild on the Gulf Coast. Did you ever read Matthew 24, kids? Because Matthew 24 says flee to the mountains. And I just saw some numbers the other day, and I thought this was kind of interesting. 50% of the American population lives within 20 miles of the ocean. Matthew 24 says that this is the time to be fleeing to the mountains, and you people want to rebuild on the Gulf Coast. Huh? Don't let me get in your way. I'm up in the mountains. I just thought I'd share that with you. Now, the solution is you don't rebuild the Gulf Coast. You get the hell out of there and you move up to the Ozarks or you move to the Rocky Mountains or you move to the Appalachians or you get the hell away from the Seacoast. That's the solution to that problem. You got a problem with public school? No big deal there. You jerk your kid out of public school and you educate him at home for approximately, let me just see what the numbers are, 7,000. Let's just take 7,000. Divide that by 546. I could educate 12 kids in public in homeschool, 12 children, 12.8, 13 kids in homeschool. For what you people are paying to educate one child in public school. I can educate 13 of my own while you're educating your one. And get off this free public education. That public education isn't free. If you're a homeowner, you're paying for it with your property taxes. And if you're a renter, you're paying it with your rent payments. You can forget about your landlord paying for or supporting your public schools. Landlords don't pay anything toward public schools. Tenants pay 100% of it. Landlords just collect the money from you tenants and pay it over to the government. They're the middlemen. All right. Now, the ultimate end of that is this. You see, if everybody in America does that, you know what's going to happen? The public schools close because there isn't any need for them anymore. And that $500 billion a year, half a trillion, that you're spending on public education, you won't have to spend anymore. You can spend it on something else, like wild women and song and White Owl cigars, something more intelligent than throwing it down that rat hole called public education. All right, now I said we're going to talk about the lawyers. I'm going to give you a couple of pointers here on the, let me just circle this off right here. Write done on that so I don't repeat that. I told you we're talking about the lawyers, and the other day I said I was going to tell you about Ben Rice and the EPA. I was running a little company called the Atlantis Manufacturing Company. Had 30 employees, produced about $1 million a year, a little over, and distributed furniture to about 11 western states. And we're doing our business and doing our thing. And one day, I was sitting in my office, and my secretary came in, and she said, there's an OSHA inspector here. OSHA? OSHA inspector. Occupational Safety and Health Administration, one of those Lyndon B. Johnson operations, you know. And I said, well, Schwinn, this guy comes in, and he's a pretty nice guy. I mean, he wasn't rude for openers, and he said he wanted to inspect my factory, and I said, what's the problem? And he said, well, we don't know what the problem is until we inspect. Now, where I come from, that's called a fishing expedition. See, nobody has complained to you. Nobody has said that there's any problem in here, but I'm going to come in and I'm going to look. What if I came up to your door and I knocked on the door? You come to the door and I say, my name is George Gordon, and I would like to come in and inspect your home. And you say, inspect my home? Why would you want to inspect my home? I'm looking for deficiencies in here. I'm looking for building code violations. I'm looking for fire code violations and things like that. It's for the health, safety, and welfare of you and your family. Oh, and if you find some of these things in here, what are you going to do? I'm going to write it up, and then I'm going to fine you several hundred dollars for every one of these violations that I find in your house. Would you want to invite me in? Well, I wasn't too excited about inviting this guy in. And besides that, I thought he needed to have a search warrant. I thought, you know, this is America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, the land of the Bill of Rights. And, you know, if you want to conduct a search, which this appeared to me to be a search, we're going to come in here and search your factory. And if we find any violations in here, we're going to write them up. Now, I never was opposed, you know, to people coming in and helping me. For instance, we had fire insurance, and our fire insurance man used to come along once a year. The guy from the fire insurance company, I don't know exactly what you called him, but anyway, he came in and he came about the same way. So, well, I'm from the fire insurance company, I come in and inspect him. So we'd invite him through. Now, he never gave us any fines, but he'd write things up. You know, he'd go through the factory and he'd write up 10 or 15 things over there. And he'd come back to my office after he got him. He said, well, I found these oily rags over here, and I found this fire door rope is broken, and I found this window over here is locked. And one thing another. And so he said, if you'll fix these things, I'll be back in 2 weeks. And if you fixed all these 14 things, then I will recommend that we not raise your fire insurance rates. Your premiums will stay the same. And if these aren't fixed, well, then this adds extra hazards to our side of the contract, and so then we'll raise your fire insurance premium. So we would hustle around the factory, and we would fix everything up real fast, and he'd come back in 2 weeks, and he'd say, God, that's really wonderful. Thank you very much. And he'd walk off, and then they wouldn't raise our fire premium rates, and that was a real service. You see, the insurance company was doing me a big favor. Now, this OSHA guy, when they come through, they're not there to do you any favors. They're there to generate revenue for their agency. They get funded by tax dollars, number one, and then I don't know what they do with all the fines that they get, but their fines at that time were about $140 each. I'd been through this fine program once before with them. So I wasn't too excited about having this guy come through because he wasn't there to help me. He was there to hurt me. He was there to harm me. And so I told him, go get a warrant. And he said he didn't need a search warrant. Can you believe that? I mean, this government agent, he comes in, he says, I don't need a search warrant. Hell, this is long before the Patriot Act. This is about 1978. Now, you see, I was out of touch with reality. I went to public school. I didn't know. I thought I was an American. I thought we had rights. I thought there was search warrants and things like that. This guy, he's from the government. He's there to help. He said, no, he didn't need one. Well, so I said, well, in this factory, you're going to need one. And he raised his voice. He got a little buppity with me. Now, this guy, I thought, was a public servant. I didn't know he was my master. I didn't. You know, I was a dummy. And so I picked this little guy up. He wasn't too big. I just picked this guy up, and I threw his ass right out in the street. And my relationship with government has been downhill from that point on. We never have seen eye to eye. Well, naturally, he wasn't too excited, and so they brought litigation, and we got into it, and we got into it kind of hot and heavy, and when it was all said and done, we did four litigations, and I beat them four times. I mean, they weren't good in court at all, and they tried to entrap me, and they sent in undercover agents, and they did all kinds of bad, wicked, terrible, awful things, I thought, but after all, you know, that's the way games are played, and so time went on, and one day, they wrote me up, and they said, well, your spray booth down there, your paint operation down there is in violation of OSHA standards. And we argued and fought with them for a long time, and things were going along. And one day, all of my business associates, all the board of directors and all the people, you know, that are your company controller, and they said, George, why do you want to fight with these people all the time? For $8,000, we can rebuild the spray booth and we'll get a clean bill of health and we'll get them out of our hair and we can go to work and get this behind us. So I relented and I said, well, I guess that makes sense. And so we spent $8,000 and we built this beautiful new spray booth. I mean, we had all the whistles and bells and all the little thingies in here that the government wanted, you know, to make the workplace happy. Now, the people who were working in the spray booth, there were some things that they wanted. There were some things they wanted. It wasn't on the government shopping list at all. And the things that were on the government shopping list, the people that actually worked in this environment said, we don't care anything at all about those whistles and bells, but here's the whistles and bells that is going to make our job easier and safer and better and one thing or another. So I went ahead and bought the whistles and bells that my employees wanted. And then I bought all the whistles and bells that the government wanted. See, so everybody got what they wanted. But I wanted to point out to you that my employees that actually worked in the environment, they weren't excited about the government's whistles and bells. There was some other whistles and bells that they wanted, so I gave it to them. Now we got this brand new spray. But things are going along here for about 6 months. And one day, an EPA guy comes in, Environmental Protection Agency, and he wants to inspect the spray booth. And he does, and he comes back, and he writes it up, and he says, this spray booth is totally inadequate. This thing doesn't work right. This thing is just a piece of trash. And I pointed out to him that this was an OSHA-approved spray booth, that this has all the government's whistles and bells, and that it meets all the standards that the government has set down. He says, oh, no, it doesn't meet the standards of our agency. By God, I knew at that point in time, things weren't running right here in our government. You know, one agency comes in and says, this is the way you need to build this, and you build it the way they want it. Another agency comes in and says, oh, no, that's all wrong. Rip that out and put it in our way. I just kind of figured, then what's going to happen? Some third agency comes in and says, nope, that isn't right. Well, what are we going to do, spend the rest of our life rebuilding the spray booth, for crying out loud? So naturally, we got into litigation. We got into it kind of hot and heavy. Well, they wrote us up, and I mentioned this to you the other day. They were talking about lawyers being hidden away. Remember, Jerry Spence said lawyers are hidden away in little backwater communities like Kuhn, Idaho, or Riverton, Wyoming. So they wrote us up, and they said they're going to put us in jail for 17 years and fine us $33,000. Well, that's kind of serious. And so we went to our attorney, Bickle, and Bickle, of course, worked out a plea bargain. They said, well, for $300, you can pay this $300 and plead guilty. Now, there's an Achilles heel to that, because once you plead guilty, that's strike one. You know, then there's strike two and strike three, and you become a repeat offender. Well, unless, of course, you're Halliburton or GlaxoSmithKline or Pfizer or some big multinational corporation. It doesn't make any difference how many times you get caught. You just pay your fines and shut up. But for little guys like us, you know, it could get kind of fatal. So anyway, I was talking to an old buddy named Casey Wright, and he said, why don't you go see Ben Rice, the lawyer? Ben Rice, the Mormon lawyer over in CUNA. Now, this Ben Rice, you know, was a one-lawyer law firm in a little backwater community. I don't know how big CUNA, Idaho is. I don't think there's 1,000 people live there. I know there's not 5,000. They got a Pizza Hut. I remember that because we spent a lot of hours talking law over at the Pizza Hut, which is the town's only industry. But anyway, the moral of the story was I went out and I talked to this guy, Ben Rice, the lawyer. And remember, I asked him, I said, well, can you win this case? He said, oh, yeah, I can win it. Well, how much is it going to cost you to win it? $4,000. And I said, I can plead guilty for $300. And he nodded his head and he said, yeah, that's the way the game's played. They come in here and they charge you with all these great crimes and threaten to put you in jail for years and years and fine you thousands and thousands of dollars, and then they'll sign a plea bargain with you for $300 so that they can get you to voluntarily plead guilty two or three times, and then they'll come down on you and catch you a third or fourth time, and they'll hammer you with a felony, throw your ass in prison. That's the way that game's played. Well, that didn't sound too good to me. So I said, I don't think we should plead guilty to this. I don't think we're guilty. And he said, he agreed. He said, you're not guilty of anything, but it's going to cost you $4,000 if you want me to go in and win this case for you. And I said, do you guarantee you're going to win this case? He said, no. God bless those lawyers, huh? Yesterday, my wife said, you were yelling down there. And I said, I wasn't either. She said, I heard you. You were yelling. And she said, who were you yelling at? And I said, I was yelling at the damn lawyers. I mean, I can just sit here talking on the radio for crying out loud. And my adrenaline gets to flowing when I'm talking about lawyers. And now here's my prospective lawyer over here telling me, no, for $4,000, I can win the case. But I'm not going to guarantee. So I said to him, I said, well, now, if I sold you some furniture, wouldn't you want me to guarantee it? And he said, oh, yeah, I'd expect you to guarantee it. But if I hire you, then you don't guarantee your work. No, we lawyers, we don't guarantee jack squat. We take your money cash up front. If we win, that's fine. If we lose, you go to jail, and we win. See, a lawyer is like a stockbroker. He always wins. He always gets paid his commission. He gets paid his commission whether the market's going up or the market's going down. He don't care. He's not losing any money. Lawyers don't lose any money. They don't care whether you go to prison or you're exonerated. That's the way that game is played. So let's wake up to reality. I said to you last time, I said, there is nobody who can represent you better than you can, because you're the guy that's going to go to jail if you lose. You're the guy that's going to get whacked with the fine if you lose, not the lawyer. So I pointed out to you, you know, you can go into court and lose free. Don't cost anything to lose. And you're going to lose 94% of the time with a lawyer. If you didn't know anything and you went into court pro se, you'd win 16% of the time if you just got on the witness stand and told your story. So that the jury can listen to both sides of the story. You'd be surprised. You know, when average Joe Sixpack, he hears your side of the story, you know, he's liable to vote for you. Well, that's the way that game is played. So I went back and I told this guy, this lawyer, Ben Rice, I said, now listen, I'll give you $4,000 to win, but I'm not going to pay you a quarter to lose. So I'll tell you what, I'll guarantee my furniture, and I worked out a trade with him. I gave him $4,000 worth of furniture, and I said, now you go in there and you win. I'll guarantee my furniture, you guarantee you win. You win, you get the furniture. You don't win, you get nothing. He mulled that over a little bit, and he said, you're on. I'll take the case for the $4,000. I'll trade you the furniture, and I'll win the case, and if I don't win the case, you don't pay. So I said, well, you're on. I went back to my office, and I told that to the board of directors, and I told it to Kagan and Watt and everybody else, and they thought I was crazy. They said, now you're nuts. You're going to spend $4,000, and for $300 we can plead guilty and get this behind us. I said, yeah, but we're going to have strike one against us, and they'll come against us again, and it'll be strike two, and then they'll come against us again, and it'll be strike three, and then they'll want to convict us for a felony because we're repeat offenders. I said, we didn't break any laws. We fixed that spray booth. We did that the way the government wanted it. That was what I saw as our defense. As it turned out, that wasn't the winning argument, but that was our defense. And so they were all against me. In fact, one of my business associates said to me, he said, if you persist in this nonsense, he thought it was nonsensical. He said, if you persist in this nonsense, he said, I'm going to go in and testify against you. I will testify for the government against you. Boy, now that's a way to win friends and influence people, ain't it? Hang on, I got to give you a reminder, and we'll be back with more on the Ben Rice lawyer story right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package to order yours. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, Ben Rice. Well, this case gets scheduled for trial, and we go to trial. And I'm a total novice. Remember, I hired an attorney, Bickle and Associates, you know. They're the guys that, with all the pieces of paper on the wall. One of the things I noticed about Ben Rice, lawyer, June, Idaho, he didn't have any pieces of paper on the wall. I can't remember a single piece of paper. He had a little one-lung office in downtown CUNA. Kind of a little one-lung office, and he had a sign out there that said, Ben Rice, lawyer. And he went in his office. He had a secretary in there. She was something else. She could sit there and type. He'd dictate to her. He talked pretty fast. She had an IBM Selectric, one of those old-timey typewriters. God, at the time, it was the greatest thing since sliced white bread. So that woman could type as fast as he could talk. I type about 10 words a minute, error free. That woman was probably typing 60, 70, 80, 90, I don't know. No pieces of paper on the wall. And we go into the courtroom, and the government came in, and they put on a hell of a good case. I got to hand it to them. The government spent God knows how much of your money to convict me. They had a van down the railroad tracks from our factory, and they were measuring the air quality. And they had witnesses that came in and testified that we were using Dutch Boy Formula 22408 lacquer paint on our products. And they could tell what time of the day or night we were using it, whether it was 8 o'clock at night in swing shift or whether it was at 10 o'clock in the morning on the day shift. They could tell us whether we were using Dutch Boy or Gibson or Glidden or you know, whose paint we were using, the batch numbers. Now, they spent a lot of money. They spent a lot of your taxpayer money on this prosecution and on this conviction. And
And they said that there was so many parts per million and so many of these little thingies floating around in the air, threatening the health, safety, and welfare of everybody that walked up around or came close to us. And I mean, they just painted us out to be real bad guys. And at 5 minutes to 12, they put on their case from 9 o'clock in the morning, bench trial, no jury, start at 9, 5 minutes to 12, 2 hours and 55 minutes. And that's your signal. At 5 minutes to 12, you want to wrap up your case so that we don't miss lunch. There's nothing that ticks a judge off more than to run into lunch hour. So always remember that. When you're in trial, you see the clock. It's 5 minutes to 12, and you're about to call another witness. You always ask the judge, "Judge, it's 5 minutes to 12, and I'm going to call another witness. It's going to take me half an hour with this witness." And then the judge will say, "Well, thank you, Mr. Gordon. We'll break for lunch right here, and we'll see you at 1:30. And always remember that in trial, you know, court, judges, court, all lawyers and judges get an hour and a half for lunch. Don't ever forget that. If you're working for a big corporation and you're in management, you get an hour for lunch. If you're a blue-collar wage earner, you get 30 minutes for lunch. So always tuck that one away in your heart. Blue-collar workers get 30 minutes. White-collar workers get 60. Lawyers and judges, we take an hour and a half. So we were about to break for lunch, and Ben, with only 5 minutes left before lunch, judge looks over and says, "Well, Mr. Rice, do you have anything before we break for lunch?" And he said, "Yes, yeah, Judge, I want to move to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case." And the judge was just shocked, It was Judge Young, and she just didn't know quite what to say. And she said, "Well, on what grounds?" He said, "Well, because Idaho Code Title 19, Section 4812 hasn't been enacted into law. It's been reserved." Did you get that, boys and girls? Hasn't been enacted into law. It's been reserved. Well, the judge called a recess, and she got up, and she left the courtroom, and she's gone about 10, 15 minutes. Now we're well into lunch hour. I mean, it's 12:15 when she comes back in. And she said, "Well, Mr. Rice, I've reviewed the statute, Title 19, Section 4812, the statute that the government's relying upon to bring this prosecution, and I find your points well taken, case dismissed." And she banged the gavel, and she got up and walked out. So the government was just shocked. They just didn't know quite what to do with themselves, and Ben and I, and our entourage, you know, we had Rick Osweiter, our plant superintendent, was there, and all of our witnesses were there. And we're walking out, and I was walking at the head of the pack there with Ben as we were walking out of the courthouse, and I asked Ben Rice this question. I said, "When do you want me to take the stand when we come back?" And he looked over at me like I was suffering from the terminal stupids, and he said, "Well, we're not coming back." And as we approached the door, I opened the door, and he walked out, and I was a little perplexed as everybody walked out the door. So I caught up with Ben, and I said, "Well, why, what do you mean we're not coming back?" And he said, "We won. We're not coming back." And I said, "When did we win?" Now, boys and girls, you got to be really stupid. I mean, you got to be really dumb. You got to be really a sluggard, you know, to have the judge dismiss your case. You walk out of the courtroom, and you're so ignorant that you don't even know that you won the case. You know, I was kind of expecting a Perry Mason triumph there at the end, you know. And when Raymond Burr, you know, didn't perform, I was expecting my lawyer, you know, to perform like Raymond Burr, you know, playing his role. Well, Ben looked over at me and he says, "We won the case and lunch is on you." That was a little side deal that we made. He said, "Not only will I win your case, but when I win your case, you buy lunch." And he says, "If I lose your case, I'll buy your lunch." And so he said, "Now lunch is on you. And on top of that, I want to eat at the Outlaw." So we went down to the Outlaw and old Ben ordered steak and French fries. Steak and fries on me. Now, while we were sitting there over lunch, I said, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, here's what happened. The EPA here in Idaho, the legislature, has not enacted any, not one, not a single air quality standard yet. They're working on it. There's a legislative committee working on it. And when they do, they're going to follow the California regulations." So what the EPA had done there in Boise, Idaho, was they took the California regulations and they wrote up a complaint and they said, "You're polluting the air and you're doing all these bad, wicked, terrible, awful things." And they ascribed an Idaho statute, Title 19, Section 4812. See? And the truth of the matter was, there wasn't any law that we had violated. Not yet. Now, if we'd have done this in Truckee, California, you know, we'd go to prison forever. But in Boise, Idaho, it wasn't against the law to pollute the air. If in fact that's what we were doing, they said that's what we were doing, that the air quality was really bad. And I said, "Well, my God, that's illegal, isn't it?" He said, "No, there's nothing illegal about it. In fact, your partner, Peter Watt, he went in and pled guilty to the very same crime. And on Wednesday, he went in, pled guilty. He paid a $300 fine and was placed on probation for 6 months. He went in and made a contract with the court. He went in and made a contract with the state. He said, 'I've been polluting the air and I feel real bad about it.' I want to plead guilty and pay a $300 fine. The judge went through the rules and said, has anybody coerced you into making this guilty plea? No. Are you making this guilty plea of your own free will and volition? Yes. And do you want to make that plea and enter it at this time? Yes, I do. Okay, well, we'll accept your guilty plea, fine you $500 or $300 and put you on probation for 6 months. Made him feel real good. Kind of like going to confession, you know, so you can confess to the priest all your bad deeds. And he felt real good. I went in 2 days later on Friday, won the case, it was dismissed. My friend Peter now has a record. He is a convicted air polluter. Now, I'm a bad guy and I've done a lot of bad things, but I'm not a dirty air polluter. I've been exonerated. Now, boys and girls, how often does the government charge people for crimes that don't even exist? It goes on all the time. You people get raped, robbed, and pillaged all the time. You don't even know it. You're pleading guilty to crimes that don't even exist. I had a guy call me the other day and said, hey, I got a ticket up here in Oregon for not wearing my seatbelt, and we don't even have a seatbelt law. Yeah, I know. I know. Now, they do that all the time. Do it all over America. And they generate a lot of revenue that way. It's a taxing measure. It's the way they generate revenue. It's like having a speed trap. That's why I teach law school. That's why, you know, one day I woke up and I said, you know, I don't think this is right. I don't think people should be convicted for crimes that don't even exist. And oftentimes people are convicted for crimes that they didn't do. Now, remember my lawyer, Bickle, he worked out a plea bargain. He was going to have us go in there and plead guilty and pay a $300 fine. That's what my partner, Peter, did. And we hadn't committed any crime. Now, are you going to tell me that Bickle, with all those pieces of paper up on the wall over there, was ignorant and dumb and didn't know? And that this dumb lawyer out in Cuna, Idaho? I mean, Bickle is in a big office, a nice office in Boise. And Rice, where's he? Oh, he's in a little cubby hole out in Cuna. Bickle and Associates, they're sitting in a big office, a prestigious building in downtown. Well, it wasn't in downtown, it was out in the suburbs, but he had a nice office, you know, kind of out off of Fairview. And here's Ben, he's out here stuck away in the sticks with no pieces of paper on the wall. He walks in and wins the case in 5 minutes. And I'm paying this law firm over here $6,000 a year to plead me guilty to a crime that didn't even exist. And then my wife wonders why I yell and scream and rant and rave and jump up and down when I'm talking about lawyers. That ain't all of it. Listen to this. Looking at the Corpus Juris Secundum, which is a legal encyclopedia, it says, attorney-client relationship. His first duty is to the courts and the public, not to the client. Did you get that? Your lawyer's first duty is to the courts and the public, not to you, the client. And wherever the duties to his client conflict with those that he owes as an officer of the court in the administration of justice, the former must yield to the latter. So if there's a conflict that comes up between the court or the public and you, the client, are paying the lawyer. You're paying the bill, but his first duty is to the court, his second duty is to the public, and his third duty is to you. Isn't that just real special? A client. You want to know how the court sees you? Listen to this. A client is one who applies to a lawyer or a counselor for advice and direction in a question of law, or commits his cause to his management in prosecuting a claim or defending against a suit in a court of justice. A client is one who retains the attorney, is responsible to him for his fees, and to whom the attorney is responsible for the management of the suit. The client is one who communicates facts to an attorney, expecting professional advice. Clients are also called wards of the court. I want to repeat that. Clients. When you hire an attorney, you become a client of your attorney. Clients are also called wards of the court in regard to their relationship with their attorneys. It's a guardian-ward relationship. You declare yourself to be incompetent. And then your lawyer goes in, and he just decides between your lawyer and the opposing counsel what they're going to do with you. And that's what the judge is talking about. See, when there's a sidebar conference. That's out of the hearing of the jury, out of the hearing of the spectators in the courtroom. That's where the judge and the two lawyers are up there talking. Well, I've been in on these sidebar conferences. Do you know what that judge and the two lawyers are talking about when they're having these sidebar conferences? Well, I'll let you in on the secret. They're talking about the defendant. You know, that defendant that's sitting over there by himself now at the defendant's table. The judge, the defendant's lawyer, and the prosecutor are all talking about that defendant. And do you know what they're talking about? They're talking about, what are we going to do with him? That's what they're talking about. What are we going to do with you? And you're not in on the conversation. Well, unless you're pro se. See, when you're pro se and you have a sidebar conference, you go up to the judge. And instead of a lawyer, it's you, the defendant. You're up there and you're talking with the prosecutor and the judge. And you know what you're talking about? You're talking about, what are we going to do with this defendant? And you're there to talk for yourself and say, well, I think we ought to cut this guy loose. And the prosecutor's sitting there saying, no, I think we ought to throw this guy in jail for 30 years. And the judge is sitting there saying, well, I don't know quite what I'm going to do with you yet, but let's try this case a little bit further and find out. That's why I always tell people, I say, you can't do any worse going into court representing yourself than with a lawyer. I mean, it's like public school. You can educate your kid at home, and you could be as dumb as a box of rocks. You can't do a worse job than public school. It's impossible. It can't be done. You can't turn out a dumber kid than public school. It hasn't happened. You'd have to work. You'd have to work 16 hours a day to turn out a kid as dumb as public school. I tell you, boys and girls, I've never met a person. I've never met a parent that's dumb enough to educate a child and turn out a product that the public schools turn out. I've yet to meet one. Now, of course, if you want your kid to turn out to be dumb, then you want to send him to public school. There's just no better place to turn out incompetent dunderheads than public education. And the same thing is true with an attorney. If you want to lose your case, you want an attorney. You want to hire legal advice. And 94% of the time, you'll lose. Now, 6% of the time, you're going to win. If you're really committed to losing, you could go in and plead guilty like my friend Peter Watt did. I mean, he wanted to plead guilty. So he went in, and the judge asks you about 20 questions. I mean, the judge is going to say, has anybody threatened you? Are you doing this voluntarily? I mean, he's going to make real sure that when you plead guilty, that you're doing this of your own free will and volition. And then my friend Peter said, yeah, he was doing it of his own free will. He wanted to be convicted. He wanted to plead guilty to polluting the air. He didn't pollute the air. He couldn't pollute the air. There was no law against what he was doing, but he felt real bad because his lawyer told him that he needed to plea bargain. And his lawyer went in for $6,000 a year on retainer, and for another, I think we paid him $1,500 to work out this plea bargain with the EPA, and he did. My friend went in, and he pled guilty to a crime he didn't commit, and he needed a lawyer to succeed at that goal. And he succeeded. Other than that, all he had to do was walk in there and say, I didn't do anything, and tell his story, and he couldn't lose. So there's that story. All right, we'll be back tomorrow night talking about more. But you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Thumbs up. Got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.